Welcome, everybody, to the new episode of The Unbalanced Note. We are so happy to be here. We're still under quarantine in day 10,384, but the sun is shining, the birds are singing, and we are just so happy to be talking about music and film on this podcast. I'm Brian Kluger, and I am joined by the co-host with the most, the man I play music with, Mark Chaffardini. How the heck are you?
I'm doing pretty terrific because I tiptoed through the tulips this morning and it was titillating.
Oh, wonderful. I like that. I like the tease. I like it all. But today we have a fantastic guest. We have the intercontinental champion, the maestro of music and scores and film, Michael Abels from Los Angeles. How are you, sir?
I am great, especially after that introduction. I am pumped up and ready to go. It's great to be here.
Well, we're so great to have you, and we can't wait to get into your repertoire of music because you've done some of the best scores and music for films such as Us, Get Out, the recent Bad Education on HBO, and a ballet recently. But first, let's start. Michael, where did it all begin for you in music? Was it something like you heard a song on the radio? Did you just hear something from a movie, play an instrument? Where did it all begin for you in music?
It began with that song, Do Re Mi, from The Sound of Music. As a little kid, that song's of your first music lesson, how to write music. It says one word for every note by mixing them up. And as a little kid, I thought, well, that's a fun game. And it gets to create all this beautiful results. So I was kind of hooked from that moment and pounded my parents till they gave me piano lessons and used to sing my heart out as a kid. So I was always involved in music as early as I can remember.
Nice. And do you remember like the first time you purchased or your parents purchased your first instrument? What was it? And what was like the first instrument you truly learned on? Was it the piano?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was born in Phoenix, but I was a little kid. I lived with my grandparents in South Dakota. And at that time, every farmhouse, at least it seemed to me, every farmhouse had a little spinet piano. And so the message I got as a little kid was like, you know what? One of the things people do is they play the piano. And when I was really, I remember being like 3 years old and just thinking I could play piano whenever I wanted. I just thought I'll just make music when I want to. And then I wanted to play Do Re Mi, and it wasn't sounding right. It was sounding like that. And I noticed that wasn't the same as what I heard in the movie. And so I asked my grandmother, I said, why doesn't it sound right? She said, well, you have to take piano lessons. And I'm like, sign me up.
So you did that. And I guess Sound of Music had a big effect on you. So after the Do Re Mi, did you try to learn the whole rest of the songs from the movie? Or did you kind of develop an ear for score or from Sound of Music specifically?
Well, you know, it's like any, kids go through their obsessions, and you know, like for like a month or two, a kid will suddenly be all about, you know, Transformers or Star Wars or whatever it is, you know. And so I had my Sound of Music phase, and I sang the score every day, and I tried to play the piano, and then I moved on to other things, but I also was, always kind of interested in what the music was doing, whether that was a movie or just a song on the radio, trying to figure out what made it all work, because it was like this really interesting puzzle. So eventually I got the ability to, you know, it used to be you could buy the sheet music of stuff. When you heard a cool song, you could go and buy it and see how it worked. And I used to do that. But then I finally, the time I got to college, I'm like, I can't afford all the sheet music. I got to learn to be able to play it by hearing it. So out of the desire to just be able to play what I heard, I started really training my ear to where I could do that. And then I was very proud of myself to having finally crossed over like that.
I like that. When you were doing piano, what was the next instrument you learned or the next instruments you wanted to tackle?
So I played some guitar because you really, you know, first of all, it's so cool, right? And everybody, you got to play guitar to be cool. So play the guitar. And not like I was a talented guitar player, but also you gotta have some understanding of every instrument. When you write for an instrument, you're kind of like, it's like you're a playwright and you can't be every character in your play, but you have to think of what the character would say, like really authentically. And that when you write for instruments or voice, you have to be able to be the playwright for that instrument. So there's nothing like actually spending some time trying to make music with it to do a good job when it comes to being that playwright. So I learned some guitar, and then, you know, and then it was about production and figuring out in the studio how to put it all together and doing things like that. So there you go.
Awesome.
This is kind of a very specific question, but you know, what I like about your scores is that you do some kind of interesting things with bells and scratching noises and some choirs, but there's no saxophone, and it brings up the bigger picture. Why hasn't there been a saxophone in a score since Michael Kamen's Die Hard? Or I'm sorry, Lethal Weapon.
You know, it's a great question, and there's definitely, you know, instruments in different decades and different, you know, episodes of the culture, different instruments and sounds go in and out of fashion. It's very much just like it's really just like fashion, where something's a trend and then suddenly it's last year's thing, and then it's suddenly from a decade ago, and then it's suddenly retro and cool again, you know? And that's true of instruments, and it especially, it switches back and forth between like sound, kind of like songs that are mostly, you can kind of tell were written on a keyboard first versus songs that were written on a guitar first. They just have this different kind of vibe to them. Anyway, so, and every instrument kind of has a stereotype that people associate with it that just comes from where you've heard it, you know? And for some reason, right, just where we are right now, the saxophones, I think, brings up images that people aren't trying to use right now. And it's too bad, because what that means is it's primed to be put in something new and have someone go, oh yeah, that's so awesome. So the sax is right there waiting for its moment that it suddenly becomes the trend. And I mean, I don't know, I hope maybe I'll get a chance to be the person who puts it in scores again. I would love to.
And I would hope that, you know, during the sessions and rehearsals, the sax players would be shirtless, because that's usually what you see. And
shirtlessness isn't encouraged in sessions, actually. I did work with a harmonica player who wore a wife beater, so. At least that was the most kind of like down home being one's true self that I have had in a studio recently. But now, you know, now that we're all like showing up on camera in our pajamas and stuff, you know, I think the shirtless sax playing is probably inevitable.
I would agree.
Well,
agree.
You know how they say that, you know how they say that when someone smiles on the telephone, you can hear it.
Yeah.
I don't think that there is any rule to tell you what clothes that someone's wearing. When you're listening to sessions, or when you listen to the, you know, the CD or vinyl, you have no way of knowing what clothes are on and what clothes are off. That's why I love film music.
Well, you've now transformed how I'm going to think of scores in the future. I have the stereotype that everybody's, you know, in the studio kind of dressed kind of glum, but now I don't know that, right? For all I know, it's actually kind of like a party atmosphere. So, okay.
As it should be. Let's get into a little bit about, I want to talk about Get Out. So I love that this score had the little guitar plucks, and it had almost kind of like a slasher vibe in it, and especially with the I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but the Sika Kiliza Kwa Wahenga, is that right? The main title.
You're a brave man. it's Sikilisa Kwa Wahenga. It's Swahili.
Okay,
means means listen to the ancestors.
Okay, okay. I was trying going back and forth in my head trying to get that right, but it was I love that sound because you took something that's usually like, you know, like Steve Martin says, you can't play a depressing song while playing usually the guitar or the banjo, but in Get Out there is that element of, oh my god, this is so scary, and I just like, this is amazing. And you walk me through your process and coming up with that score and specifically those chords and how you got it to sound so haunting.
Well, thank you very much. So first, that started with, you know, the first talk, face-to-face talk I ever had with Jordan Peele. He's such a student of suspense and horror. He genuinely loves the genre and everything about it and finds it to be this hugely creative, expressive field that maybe other people don't necessarily notice it as well as he does. So he, not only does he know everything about the genre and why it works, but he also knows the scores to all of these films. And we had a great conversation about what makes things scary, and, you know, in music, and essentially it's the unfamiliar. But in that scene, when you first hear the main title, Siki Liza Kwawahenga, what's going on is Chris is being, they're driving to upstate, you know, it's kind of implied that it's upstate New York, or it's the countryside anyway, to visit Rose's parents. And you see, looking out the window, you see all the trees going by. And one of the points Jordan was making to me was that, you know, he's a city boy. So to him, the country being unfamiliar, the country's scary. And so the background of that song kind of is the kind of meant to sound like twist. It's not a banjo, but like twisted banjo. Or scary, it's like scary bluegrass. And because what's scarier to a black person than a bunch of rednecks? You know, to be right. Quite honest. And that's the part of the turnaround of Get Out, is that you need, no matter who you are, you need to be able to see the world through Chris's eyes. And you have to be able to look at the world through a young black man who's out of his element. And so scary bluegrass, first of all. And then second, the idea of the voices is that they're really the voices of departed slaves and lynching victims and anyone who's been a victim of social injustice. And they're trying to warn Chris. What they're really saying is get out, you know. But ghosts don't speak to us. You know, ghosts don't tell us what's on their minds. They speak to us in metaphors and dreams and shadows. So they couldn't just come on and sing, Chris, get out. Plus, it gives away the movie. So Swahili is a very, slaves, it turns out that I guess most slaves didn't speak Swahili, but I needed a little poetic license. And Swahili is a very musical language. So I started just writing, trying to think of phrases they would say and then translating them into Swahili and seeing how they sounded. And so the words are, first, brother, because when you hear black voices speaking to black people, like, yeah, and that one word needs no translation. I thought they just say brother, and everyone knows who's speaking and who's being spoken to. And then they say, Siki Liza Kwawahenga, listen to the ancestors. Kimbia, run. Una kimbia mbali, run far away. Brother, Siki Liza Kwaukweli, listen to the truth. Kimbia, kimbia. Kua kua menyewe, which means save yourself.
Phenomenal. And that is such a beautiful language. It just sounds so way better than anything English can sound like. I love that.
Well, what I've noticed is that the music of different cultures, it's very much associated with how the language works. And so a lot of the awesome rhythmic things that you hear in African music, I think, you know, is related to the language. And Swahili has such a wonderful flow to the way the syllables go together. So when anything you say in Swahili just has this beautiful kind of naturally musical rhythm, at least to my ear.
Well, as Brian picked up, there were the plucking noises, but what What were the dragging sounds? I'm not sure if I'm describing that right, and I don't even have the track to mention it. But like, what was the, you know, just the, again, the instruments are used in very unique fashions and kind of disorienting, which kind of mimics what Chris is going through. But what were the dragging noises, and how were that created?
Dragging. It sounds like, you mean like there's like scraping sort of sounds, maybe.
Yeah, kind of. It's a little different from what in Us. It sounded like it was like a buzzsaw starting.
In Sikileza Kwawahenga, there's some kind of, there's some bowed cymbal sounds, you know, a cymbal like you'd hit with a stick. But if you take a bow, like a bow for a violin, you can take instruments like cymbals and you can bow the edge of them. And it creates this really wonderful ethereal, it has sort of a scrape to it because you hear the bow against the metal, but it also, the cymbal vibrates with all of its wonderful harmonics that it has. And it's both dissonant, but it sounds very alive. And so there's some sounds like that going on in the background. That's probably what you heard. And then there's, of course, there's rolled, there's some drum rolls, and drum rolls are low and have a, you know, loud enough they sound like an earthquake, but it just at some levels they are distant rumbles that you feel rather than hear.
Very cool. Very cool.
What is it like? What is the vibe in the studio when you're on the session? You know, is there a sense of dread when people hear this music? Do you watch the picture and feel worse when you're having it all put together? How do the musicians react?
What's a good answer to that? So musicians are very, so there's a difference between, there's a different culture between instrumental musicians and singers. So instrumentalists are kind of, they train themselves to compartmentalize. Like instrumentalists are kind of just like, they don't care what's going on around you. It's like, what note am I playing? When do I play it? How loud do you want it? And how, you know, it's all this really technical stuff that seems very divorced from the response, but it has to do with focusing on doing a really excellent job. And so kind of musicians are trying to, whether it's so beautiful that you're tearing up or it's so terrifying that you want to jump out of your seat. If you look at most musicians, they're just kind of sitting there doing their thing. But it helps them do better, because if they were to actually have the experience of the audience, they wouldn't be able to do it as well. So a lot of times when you, musicians will only express their emotion about it after the take is over and you're on break, you know, and they're sort of out of their business mode. But singers, you know, it's the voice comes from within you. And just like you can tell when someone is smiling when they're speaking on the phone or on a podcast, you can't sing any lyrics without feeling and understanding what it's coming from. So with singers, explanation of Sikileza, I broke that all down for them. And of course, they'd never seen the movie because it hadn't been released. And so it's really important. It's really important that you communicate with singers about what's going on, because they need to be able to absolutely act the part. And so if that means, and sometimes that means watching the scene. And like, and when, in Us, particularly, I had the picture there with me. And so I would have them watch some of what they were doing. But then that's also very distracting. So a lot of times it's just to help them understand who they are. And then when they're doing the take, they're not watching the picture.
I like that aspect. And I love that you, Michael, use the a great mix of ingredients of instruments, orchestra, guitars, and actually voices and choir from everything from Get Out to Bad Education. And they all sound like in a different genre to me. And I'm just curious.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
No, it's good, because, you know, watching Bad Education, there's a little bit of that, you know, almost like a little bit of pomp and circumstance in those themes, and then also the voices. Totally. And it just sounds so different and then something from Us. And I just love how you use the mix of all of these elements to bring it to like actually just something that I would want to listen to, like in the car or just at home while I'm having a whiskey. And I was curious on like how that process happens.
Well, so first of all, people have been really kind about us. People will say to me, "Oh, I listen to us when I'm in my car," and like I'm, and to me as a driver, I'm thinking, stop and don't listen to us in your car. I don't want to be driving next to you listening to us. That freaks me out. I don't listen to us in my car. I want to like relax and zoned and anyway. But I love that people can listen to the music I've written, and it's a huge compliment. About the different genres. So you can tell that from because my first impression of music was it's one word for every note by mixing it up, right?
Right.
I kind of look at music like language. And languages, even within a language, there's different, if you're from a different part of the country, you're going to say something in a way that has different words have different emphasis. There's different pronunciation. I'm from LA, but if someone from Scotland talks to me, I'm lucky if I can get half of the actual words they're saying, you know? I just find the Scottish accent to be very difficult for my ear, even though I love the sound of it. So what I'm saying is that this is how music works. Underneath, you strip back the fashion, you strip back the instruments, you strip back the, I don't know, whatever else that makes it feel like a certain genre to you. Underneath, it works the same way. And so therefore, there's no particular music that needs to be any one genre at its base form. It's everything else you add to it that creates people identifying it with a certain artist or brand of music. So therefore, it's possible to take voices and orchestral instruments and guitars and process sound and write any style of music, because what you're going to be changing is kind of the way the word, the way the order of the words and the sentence structure underneath the music, if that makes any sense. And so Bad Education, the whole idea is to sound like Pom. It takes place at a very well-to-do school and the hallowed halls of education, you know, all those kids are trying to get into Harvard or Yale or, you know, like to not get into an Ivy League school is like a failure in their culture, sadly. So you wanted music in Bad Education that really gives you that sense of, you know, classical higher education in that very well-to-do sense. And so classical music is great for that. So it's a lot of the same instruments, but the way the music fits together is done in according to the rules of classical music. And as a result, you know, you get a very different sound.
Right, right. And then, you know, you, correct me if I'm wrong, but you worked as a school music director for a while. And did any of that transfer over to the scores or in Bad Education or anything like that?
Well, it was really fun to have been in that world and then be, you know, writing music for a film where I see that world. There are scenes in Bad Education where I've been in that scene, you know. That's exactly how it happened. The scenes with there's a mother who's very insistent that her son isn't getting the proper, you know, focus in the classroom, and she is going to be, you know, she's not going to stop until she makes sure this is corrected. And I've been in that scene, let me tell you. Anyway, so it was great to be able to tell the director, you know, I've been there, but the music, you know, the music in the film is used to tell the story and help us understand the characters, you know? And so at the school that I was at, there was some classical music, but it's not like it was, you would think that, you know, I mean, it was a very different school. And so, you know, and the music was about the students who were there. The music in the film Bad Education is about telling the story, and there's a vibe you need to get off of that story that it's this grand, it's a dark, so the film's a dark comedy, really. It's actually pretty funny, but there's a kind of tragic element to what happens, and people don't think of schools as being, a school seems like a small stage. So it's like a grand tragedy on maybe a stage that's a little too small for the tragedy. And that's kind of what the humor comes from, and seeing just, you know, the human frailty and how people who are trying to do the right thing end up doing completely the wrong thing in spite of themselves, sort of.
Well, picking up on Bad Education, a couple things I noticed is that music is very sparse. And I'm wondering, was it difficult to find things that inspired you in the story? And more to that point, do you get inspired by talks with the director or certain scenes in the film, or just, you know, one element of a script or something? You know, what kind of drove you to the boat?
So there's a lot there. That's a great question. So first of all, it always starts with what the director is trying. The story the director wants to tell is job one, and your job is to help tell that story, the sonic world of that story, the way the director wants to tell it. So yeah, talking to the director is the first step, and it's always what you're going back to figure out which of all the emotions you could feel from watching a scene, which one is the one that the director wants most of the audience to have, you know? And so that's first. Then second, in the case of Bad Education, Corey, the director, Corey Finley, he knew he wanted classical sound. So he told me, you know, I'm really looking for a very classical score. But there's also, there's the existing world of the school, and then there's what starts to happen underneath everything. And there's a story that's gradually uncovered, you know, and they think that no one's going to notice, but that's not what happens. So there is some very sparse music, and that sparse music is used to represent that story gradually coming to light. And it was kind of inspired by, so there's a scene where you see a ceiling in the school, and it's one of those acoustical ceilings that, you know, but it's got a leak, and there's water leaking through, and it's dripping, drip, drip. And that's kind of what the story is. The story is a series of little clues that reveal themselves until they all come together pretty dramatically. So the sparse music is literally a audio representation of that drip that we see as the clues are beginning to come out. And that was the inspiration for that. But then also there's tension, there's a mystery. And so this mystery that's gonna upset this beautiful, sacred old hallowed halls vibe, it needs to feel, you need to feel the tension of that and how different it is from the existing world that the film starts with. And so the music being as different from the classical music as it is just one more way to show that there's really two worlds here, and you're about to find the one that people don't see.
Gotcha. Well, I'm glad you said that, because, you know, you mentioned before it's a dark comedy, and what I noticed is that it almost seems like there's obviously a duality between what you're seeing and what the actual story is, but it's almost a bit of cynicism in a way. You know, they're number four. There's this sort of, as you said, pomp and circumstance, but there's this, it's almost like a feigned superiority, a feigned professionalism that is just a facade for this story that is anything but. And I'm wondering, did you maybe overdo the classical to sort of counterbalance the story?
Well, the classical is really over the top. There's a couple cues that are giant, and that whenever you're doing, I mean, that's the beauty of film in general, that there's, you have a chance to present a heightened reality. And whether that's played for, you know, seriousness and just to heighten emotion, or whether that's kind of exaggerated to do a little bit of satire, you know, either one is good. And it's interesting. The ones that are over the top, it's a little bit satirical for sure. It's also in doing comedy, you know, comedy is very delicate in what's funny and what isn't. And the timing and the, what you notice in the screen and the characters, you know, it's a little facial tick, maybe. There's a scene also about Bad Education. There are a lot of scenes that have no music at all. They're just played completely dry, so to speak. And when you score a film, you have to watch it so many times. And one of my favorite scenes is one with no music at all, where we see Pam Gluckin's niece, and Frank Tassone is, she's thinking she's getting a promotion, and that is not what Frank Tassone wants to happen. And there's this great scene that they face off each other in a very business professional on the surface, but really kind of politically dirty underneath. And it's so great to watch because it's in their little facial tics that that the comedy comes out of what they're really saying to each other. And it has nothing to do with music. That's how the music works as well, is that when something's just a little over the top or a little turned in one direction, that's kind of the juicy spot that makes it really fun to watch.
Very cool. Very cool. And I want to ask this question to you. So I did a little research. I read about this story. And I just want to say, like, okay, so Steven Spielberg has probably made some of the bigger movies in Hollywood. But not only that, in many stories about Spielberg, he exudes just film love, film passion. He's just like this purveyor of cinema and loves to discuss movies with a lot of people. And I heard a story about how he talked about you and your music, right? Is that true? Do you talk about that?
Well, I think it's true. It was told to me, but it was told to me by Jordan. Jordan, after Get Out came out, it must have been out, I don't know, only about a week or two, and Steven Spielberg called him. Jordan is an amazingly talented guy who's been in the business for a while and knows everybody and does, you know, 8 or 10 different things really well. But remember, when Get Out had just come out, it was his first film that he had directed, you know? And so for a first-time filmmaker to get a call from Steven Spielberg, that was something.
Right.
And so Spielberg, I guess, was on the phone with him for a half hour, not just saying, hey, you know, good job, but like breaking the film down with him. Like, this scene was so great, and where'd you, you know, and this idea and that idea, and oh, it all, you know, was very complimentary. So that was just incredible. And I guess among all the really great things he said to Jordan about Get Out, he said, and this composer guy, Michael Abels, where'd you get him? You know, and he like said, and Steven Spielberg knows his film music, and every Steven Spielberg movie has an amazing soundtrack. Most of them, 95% of them, by John Williams, who's the greatest film composer in the history of the genre. And so for him to notice my music and to actually ask Jordan and say that I made a great contribution, it was just like the best compliment I could ever get.
That is otherworldly, and that is such a cool thing, especially on the first film that you paired up with together.
Yeah. And Spielberg told him that he needed to hang on to me, and that was like, oh my, thank you, Mr. Spielberg.
I feel like that's like you could put that on a resume, like Spielberg said.
Actually, it's on the back of my business card. Actually, it's like no, it's not, but it ought to be. If I was smart, it would be.
No, that is too cool. That is too cool. And so, you know, earlier on in this show that we've been doing with you, it seemed like you're at your piano.
Oh, I am.
So I'm curious, what is the most haunting song or score? And then to the opposite of that, what's the most romantic, sexiest song or score? And do you play them at the house to capture the mood?
Wow, these are great questions. So I don't play them to capture the mood. Some things, like the scariest score, a lot of the scariest music, and this was why Jordan, I think, ended up hiring me, was because a lot of the scariest music is music that wasn't originally written for film, but was written for the concert hall. A lot of especially 20th century, but not only. But 20th century concert music was designed to just really push every possible boundary of music. And so it's very atonal and very experimental. And in a film, that equals terrifying. And so there's pieces by Penderecki, who is a wonderful Polish composer who only just died about last month, unfortunately. I think he's a Hungarian composer named Ligeti. And some of the music they've written, when paired with the right visuals, just is gripping. But it can't be played on the piano or anything like that, because it involves scraping the instruments in strange ways, or doing things that would sound like me with my elbow on the piano. But the thing is that to be able to write music where it sounds like your elbow is on the piano, but it also works with the picture, like that's actually a very subtle knife's edge to be able to dance on. And even though when I'm writing music that's supposed to sound just maybe kind of random or make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, the difference between doing that well and doing it so it's just noise is actually pretty hard. So when I put my elbow on the keyboard in film music, I'm really doing it in a way that I really have spent a lot of time figuring out which elbow to put where, if that makes any sense.
Oh, that does.
And about romantic music, yes, like, I can think of some. There's beautiful romantic moments in many scores. The score isn't usually all romantic or... I wish I had a much more vast knowledge than I do, but I must say that if you want to hear a romantic score, I can recommend Bernard Herrmann's Taxi Driver. It's a very romantic
score. And there's saxophone in that.
There is. There is saxophone right up front.
And I agree with you with Taxi Driver. Even though there's nothing really romantic about that movie, I think it's like Scorsese and Herrmann telling the story about the city and what it could be. There's something sexy about the taxi cabs at night for some reason.
Yes, and I mean, the score is deliberately there to add a completely different vibe than if you were just watching Travis Bickle and thinking he was a little odd. If with the score, instead, you think that he's an anti-hero, you know, and that's exactly how that movie works. And the score is just crucial to do that. And Bernard Herrmann is, of course, a genius. So anyway.
Right. And I loved your addition to the haunting ones about going classical, because I think Stanley Kubrick and The Shining did a good job with that, pulling music from hundreds of years ago. And then even, you know, with Philip Glass's score for Candyman, with the piano, that da-na-na-na-na, boom, boom. And I just think that, like, that it's more affecting. That is pretty great. And I think your scores in Get Out and Us have that classical and even tribal aspect to it that just, like, really pushes it home. And just like, oh, gosh, because I think music adds, like, so more than maybe most elements of a film to make the movie work. And I think your scores definitely enhance every part of a film.
Thank you so much. Well, music is so, you know, of course, as a musician, I think that music is just the highest art one can have. And I hope every artist thinks that their art is that. But I've always loved how music can just describe emotion in a way that I'm still amazed by, even whether it's music I hear or music I write, just the way music makes you feel is like nothing else. And also, because it's auditory, most of us are visually oriented people. And, you know, and of course our ears are important, but our primary way of processing information comes through our eyes. So the auditory information kind of slips in behind the scenes when you're not thinking about it. And when you put that together, that music touches the emotion and you can be unaware of it, it becomes this just this magic power in any film where the filmmaker has a way of connecting directly to the audience's emotions without the audience even being really aware of it. And so the idea of being able to do that and being able to communicate with people that way is just, it's a huge privilege, and I love doing it every day.
Well, you certainly set the stage for a film like Us with that creepy choir. It definitely got people in the mood, whether they wanted to go on the ride or not, and definitely let them know that this is not going to be over quickly and things are not going to be safe. So.
Well, good. That's exactly what it's supposed to say. That's exactly. It's very, so the idea of that one, the anthem, which we hear at the beginning of the film, is that it's supposed to be, you're supposed to know that, you know, something dark is happening and there's a whole bunch of people and it feels like they're organizing and it's not good. So the words are just nonsense. Or I'm trying, you know, it turns out there's no such thing as nonsense. I agreed with Jordan, it'll just be nonsense. And then when I went to write it, I'm like, oh, everything means something, actually. Because even when a baby cries, like when a baby cries, what's our first thing? You try to figure out what it means. What does the baby want? Is this a happy cry? Is this a bad cry, right? So anything that comes out of your mouth, kind of someone is going to try to have that mean something. So to try to write words that don't sound like something is really difficult. And I got a lot of respect for Dr. Seuss when I was trying to write that. But the music sounds like, you know, when people organize, when there's evil on the march, what's the thing? The word march, right? I thought it's got to be a march. It's got to sound like marching. But it also needs to not sound like it's coming from any particular culture, you know, because in Us, Red, who's the doppelganger of Addie, who's Lupita Nyong'o's character, someone asks her, says, "What are you people?" And she cocks her head in a wry joke and she says, "We're Americans." And that's a really key point in understanding the evil in Us, that the evil is us. It comes from us, and we shouldn't be looking at these scary people as the other. We should be looking at them as ourselves. And so it needed to sound like a multicultural march, kind of in the scary way that America is a multicultural society. So we were thinking about how do we do that? And then the thing is that if you do music that sounds like it's from other cultures, then it's not a march. You know, this little problem was something I spent a long time wrestling with. So I realized, well, here's what I'll do. First with the march, I'll slow it way down. It won't be going long, dun, dun, dun. It'll be like dun, 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 dun. Because then you notice the space in between each of the words, and that space really adds to the suspense and the tension, actually. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, it's going to be a march, and it's going to sound kind of, you know, Latin-y, not Latin like Latinx, but like actually like the language Latin. But it's because of the way the music works that it sounds that way. But I thought, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a really funky beat behind it, because that's going to be, you know, we were talking about African music before. That's going to be my multicultural spin that I'm going to put on it, so that it's a slow march that kind of, you know, makes you want to move. And that's going to feel very not of any one culture. It's going to feel multicultural in a way. And that's my shot at it. So that's what the anthem is doing, is making you feel like evil's on the march, but it's evil that comes from a bunch of places at the same time.
Very cool.
That's amazing. And then in order to make your score gel with the rest of the story, you know, sometimes you have, you know, to tailor something to a scene, or sometimes maybe a song would get in the way. Do you ever have, I know you don't select the songs, that's what the music supervisor does, but do you ever get in a situation where, hey, if I could just give this 30 more seconds, can we push that song back? Or maybe, do you have any say in where songs land to maybe give yourself more of a canvas?
That's a great question, actually. I have a little bit, but it's not, it happens kind of in the background rather than, like, no one says, okay, you're going to do this. You know, it doesn't happen that way. It's that a bunch of things, like a bunch of people are working on the post-production of a film at the same time. First is the director, who obviously is captaining the ship. Second is the editor, who's the post-production is really the editor's world. And every single art that works on the film comes together through the editor's eye and putting everything together. And then, but there's the music supervisor who's working on some places in the film where the director knows that he or she wants songs. And maybe those songs have already been picked out and they've been editing to them from the beginning. So there's both songs that the music supervisor is looking for where we don't know what we want. And then there's the songs that we definitely know what we want. And what we're just trying to do is, you know, find the money to be able to make those people say yes. But when I say we, none of that happens with me. That's the music supervisor and the producers are dealing with that. Then I'm trying to write the score and figure out how the score is going to contribute and go, you know, and through scenes that are changing length and times, of course, I'm also adjusting to that. Where that interlap happens is where sometimes, like Jordan likes when I do music before the film is shot, like Anthem, I did before he even shot it, and he played it for people on set because he knew he wanted to use it. So consequently, Nick edited to the Anthem. And so when you notice the, it's all one shot. It's just that long shot of the rabbits, which is freaky enough, but the titles, the credits pop on and off in time with the music. And while that's a subtle thing, that doesn't happen if the editor doesn't edit to the music. And so it really gives you that sense of it's a little music video within the film. And so I was the one who set the pace of how that was going to go, you know, and that I was saying this should go in this way. But I didn't say to them, okay, I'm going to write an anthem and you're going to, you know, because it's whether Jordan is feeling it and whether the director is, if you, as a composer, if I want them to edit to the music, I got to write them some music that's going to inspire them that that's a great idea. See what I mean? So there was another scene in Us that is the immolation, where I don't want to, without spoilers, but someone ends up burning and you see it happen. You see it's being set up in a very dramatic way. And that's very much a kind of a song that's kind of operatic because there's all this choir singing. And there's a pace of that. But Nick, the editor, set that pace. And then I matched that pace and I noticed how it was going. And then I wrote music that went to that pacing. Because we wanted it to kind of look like the editing was happening to the music, but it actually happened in reverse. But that's where I'm following the leader of, you know, someone else is managing that one, and then I'm making, but we know what the result is. We want the music to seem like it's really a feature, so I'm cooperating to pull off that illusion. That's a long answer, but maybe that gives you some idea.
I like that. I like that. Let's have a little fun, shall we? Michael, what's the most curious record or recording in your collection? Like something that you have a recording of that's just fantastically bizarre.
That would be the Shags. Shags are a group. I can't even describe the Shags. I wouldn't do it justice. I would just say people have to Google the Shags. I never thought I'd be talking about that record, but no, it's called Philosophy of the World is what it's called. And it's just an amazing recording that is either brilliant or terrible, depending on your perspective.
Oh, the rich people want what the poor people's got, and the poor people want what the rich people's got, and the skinny people want what the fat people's got, and the
you can listen to it either way, actually, depending on what mindset you're in. And I haven't heard it in years, but I would recognize any of the music immediately. So.
Right. Okay. So I just looked them up, and I guess Kurt Cobain listed Philosophy of the World as his fifth favorite album of all time, and it was influential by one of my favorite people, Frank Zappa.
Yep. So,
now I need to get this.
And I would love to explain it to you, but like to do that, I would have to characterize the music. I would have to use adjectives. And I think that that's unfair, actually. That it's unfair for me to give you any kind of pre-experience of that record. You should hear it purely with your own experience.
Okay, so can we listen to this at some point and then get back to you on thoughts?
Totally, totally.
Okay, great, great, great. Also,
we should have a live listen. We'll call it Micah Label's listening party.
Oh God.
I like that. I like that. Also, okay, the Shag's philosophy of the world. No, I'm seeing like the album cover and everything, and I'm just okay. I'm all in.
Awesome, awesome.
Okay,
I'm happy to turn you onto it.
All right, awesome. And can you list some artists, musicians, composers who have helped shape your creative life?
God, really, just you know, anyone you discover, especially as you're growing up, anyone you discover and then come to, you know, appreciate their music, and you go through one of those phases like a kid, you know. And so I got to start with Rodgers and Hammerstein because of Do Re Mi. I remember all of the early Elton John records, and just because of course of the pianist, you know, I'm just like, oh my gosh, what, you know, listen to what's going on here. Another piano player would have been Billy Joel, who broke through right then and when I was, you know, young. And he did a couple of albums right then that were just so great in their songwriting. And I don't think he's really, I don't think he's nearly as appreciated these days as he ought to be as a songwriter, for sure. Then in concert music, I mean, all of the great composers. I would sit in music history class and just, well, I was not an easy student in college, but I would definitely have an opinion of each composer and whether their music worked or didn't. And if we were studying someone whose music I didn't like, I was really not very happy. but you hear Wagner, you hear Stravinsky, you hear Prokofiev, just incredible composers who can tell a story, and you can hear the story unfold in your mind without a word being spoken. Just extraordinary gifts. So
there's a the name of a track at the end of Bad Education helped me understand the movie a little better. It's called History as It Should Have Been. Mm. And to me, it's not a spoiler like the death of Qui-Gon Jinn, like on the John Williams score to The Phantom Menace, but but it definitely helped me go, oh, so that's what it was. The Rosalind went from fourth to first, and none of this ever happened, or he never got caught. Yeah. But do you have fun naming things? Do you have any, you know, Easter eggs you try to drop in a title track, or you know, just fun when you're putting these lists together?
What happens is you, in preparing a soundtrack, you are unfortunately distracted by other things. it happens kind of in the background of your life, strangely. And I'm always thinking, you know, when someone sees this, they're really going to be focused on this. And I want them to have a good experience of that. This was, you know, thought of. But when you're writing the music, you know what it's called? QM2-17. And that's how you have to refer to it, not because you wouldn't give it a title, but because there's about 60 other people that need to understand things about that piece of music, and it's much better articulated in a number than a name. So then if there's a soundtrack album, you suddenly go back and retitle things, and you have to think about, okay, what characterizes this music? And am I going to talk about just the music or the scene or part that together, you know? And that been, and when I'm writing a piece of concert music, the title is usually what comes first. It helps me crystallize what it is, as opposed to in the soundtrack where the title is a label when you're done. So it's very different. But I do think about those things, and the scene at the end of Bad Education, it suddenly ends with a dream sequence, but there's no there's no warning. There's no other dream sequence in the movie. And there's no warning to the audience that we're entering, you know, there's none of that. It can remember it like it was yesterday, you know, the usual cues that they do for a flashback or a dream. And it's left for the audience to figure out that we're in a dream sequence. And so entitling it History as It Should Have Been, it was both. It was that this is really what's going on in the scene in that title. But also, if it did help someone understand the movie, then I think that's good. But you asked me about Easter eggs. And so sometimes there's Easter eggs in... On the Bad Education soundtrack, there's an alternate take of a piece called Eye Contact. And there's no... just if you just hear the soundtrack, even though it says it's called the Appassionato mix, and there's no explanation. And you might not, you might, and I thought, well, people will just have to, it's a little Easter egg for people to figure out. And they have to listen to this podcast, I guess, to know the story. But the story is, there's a love scene in Bad Education, and the characters in it, and it happens surprisingly, and the characters, there's a lot of tension and kind of, it's kind of illicit, and the characters don't even know what to think of it, or at least one of them doesn't. And the audience might not know what to think of it. And so the cue is called Eye Contact, because that's one of the lines that one of the characters says right beforehand. And the music's very, it's a classical score, so it needs to sound like classical music, but it also needs to sound like passion, but forbidden. Forbidden passion is what's supposed to happen. So I wrote this cue and I recorded it with strings, and Corey, the director, said, "Eye Contact is insanely gorgeous. Can you change the first three chords?" Which is a kind of a really typical note in Hollywood, because it's both a typical good note, actually, because it's both really encouraging and also like gives you this assignment that seems impossible. And I've given that same note to players in the studio too. It's like, oh my God, I need you to do one more take. Everything you did was great, but in bar four it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a crescendo. Bar three is going to be tenuto, and then bar six is much faster. But it's so good. Everything you did is perfect. Keep doing that. So that's what he was telling me. So my job is to get to yes. And at first I thought, well, no, I can't do that. It's a totally different piece, but I realized I can't change the first chord change. There's something about it that has this longing. I can't change it. There's no other thing that's going to do that, but that I could change the second chord and I could change the third one. And I could, and the problem that he was having with it was that it was too dark, and it was too, that, you know, that torture that I mentioned, that emotional torture that I mentioned in the scene, I was actually dialing into that too much. And he wanted a little less of that, but only a little less, you know? So I changed the second chord and the third chord, and suddenly it was a little better. And then we redid it, and then he loved that one. So that was the one that's in the film. But then the alternate is the one that's just a little more passionate, for better or worse, but it's not in the movie.
That's awesome.
That is good.
Appreciate you sharing.
That is great. And to round this episode out, Michael, what is your most personal, thrilling music experience? Whether it be the first time you saw a concert live, conducting a symphony, or the first time you heard a record, what to you is your most thrilling music experience?
Gosh. Different ones for different reasons. I saw Bruce Springsteen in concert.
That's the boss.
One. Yeah. I saw Empire Strikes Back in the theater, and that was thrilling. And part of it is, you know, any musical, any, you know, experience you have is enhanced by what it took to get there, right?
Right.
So that was one of those days when you had to line up at the theater and line around the block and be there for hours. And I had to do that. So you can bet when I finally got that movie, it was great. But also the score to that the score to that film is really an opera in itself. It's just incredible. And so that was one. And what else? There's an actual opera called The Ghosts of Versailles by a composer named John Corigliano, which is a masterpiece. It was written in the 1990s. And the piece is just a masterpiece in so many ways. And you can rarely get to see an opera live. You know, you have to be lucky enough that someone near you is going to actually put it on. So that was a highlight for me. There was a piece by John Adams called Harmonilehre. And I heard that in the 80s, and I didn't know. I went to the concert not knowing what I was going to expect, and to discover that I loved that, you know, that they played this piece that I loved, was really was wonderful. So that's a few.
Awesome. Very, very cool. I like it. And I just want to say thank you for joining, and thank you for coming on to the podcast. Is there anywhere you want to tell the listeners and the readers out there to connect with you, whether it be a website or social media?
I got a website, that's for sure, michaelables.com. And you can find me on Twitter at michaelables. So there you go.
Well, all right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate Michael Abels, you being here. And until next time, you know, listen to his amazing scores. Watch Bad Education on HBO. Buy these soundtracks on vinyl, CD, or download them. I mean, what do you prefer, Michael? Do you prefer people to get stuff on the records or CDs or digitally?
Oh gosh, it's whatever's gonna make you enjoy the music. You know, I love the vinyl releases, but the secret is I don't play vinyl. I feel bad, but I don't. So like, if I'm gonna buy a score, it's gonna be on, you know, in some digital format. But if you love vinyl, I love having the vinyl, and I love signing them for people and stuff. So whatever format works for you, I'm all in.
That sounds good. Thank you again so much, and we will see you next week.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. So that was fun. Michael Abels is amazing. Please check his work out online. But yeah, this is the Unbalanced Note. We are the Multimedia Men Podcast Network on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, and I'm Brian Kluger. Boomstick Comics, High Def Digest, Screen Rant, YouTube, look me up. And I recently got back on Instagram, been posting some funny videos. And of course, you can find Mark Chaffardini all over them interwebs at
GoCTalk.com. It's so good, you'll slap your mama. No, I'm just kidding. But it is pretty dope. Check us out on Twitter, YouTube. You can come find me in Texas. If you show up with food, you'll be allowed in. Otherwise, just leave it on the doorstep and get the hell out of here.
Wise words from a great man. All right. We'll see you next week.